We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Here's a good idea. Have a point. It makes it so much more interesting for the listener.
Welcome back to Overnight America. Brad Young sitting in for the vacationing Ryan Recker. Glad you are in with us this evening on 50,000 red hot watts here on 1120 KMOX. Before the break, we were talking about a situation that occurred in Tennessee where a person posted not just a negative review, which would be legal and fine, but a potentially libelous and slanderous review. And before we break down the legalities of what can you or can't you post and what can you or can you not be sued over, we've got an interesting call. Bob is calling in. Bob's a physician. And Bob, you've got a comment on reviews like on Yelp and so forth. What's your comment this evening?
Hey, good evening. You know, whether you're in a, depends on what service industry you're in, whether you're selling pizzas or changing oil or taking care of people as a neurologist in Tennessee would do, you know, you're fair game, I think. People are going to comment, whether they go and comment just word of mouth, whether they go post it on the computer. And you have to look at the collective whole of what people are saying. And so, you know, if I look at a Yelp review on a restaurant and I see 20 great reviews and one person says it was the worst meal they ever had, I tend to disregard the one, and I go with the
Certainly.
Collective whole. And so, you know, I think as a physician, you have to just have thick skin and you have to be willing to realize that not everybody's going to be pleased with the interaction. And there's going to be other people that think it's fantastic. And, you know, you got to take the good with the bad. And as a specialist, like a neurologist down in Tennessee, a lot of that person's business is going to come from referrals from primary care folks.
Sure.
So as long as the person's referral base knows what kind of competence or kindness that person shows, it's not going to affect their business much. So I think that physicians probably could use their time better.
I think so, too. Have you ever had to deal with a similar type of situation where someone posted a review that you disagreed with? Has that ever happened to you?
Yeah. In fact, I think if I go Google my name, I think the first thing that comes up is a negative review. And I don't really care because the person that I know who did it, and I know the reason they did it was because they were seeking narcotics for inappropriate reasons, and I wouldn't give them to them. And so they
Good
went online
you.
And said, well, this physician's I'm in terrible pain, and this physician wouldn't treat me. And, you know, which was false. I treated the patient for a lot of other things, but I wouldn't go down that path. And so, you know, I put my head on the pillow and rest well at night knowing that I did the right thing in that case. And I think, again, it depends on what service you're in, what service industry you're in. You're going to have to deal with that. And it's just part of being in business.
In the litigation, Bob, that I deal with as an attorney, I've deposed plaintiffs before who have told me how terrible and awful and rotten this particular physician was in the course of a deposition. But once I probed further, just like your situation, I found that typically that related back to the doctor not doing what the patient wanted. And it was the doctor's professional opinion that that person didn't need whatever service or drug or medication or process that that person thought they needed. Is that something that you deal with? And I'm not talking about in the area of reviews, but in this area of where patients are so educated now by Dr. Google, do people come in and have expectations to you as a physician that you have to manage and deal with?
Absolutely. And I think that that's just part of the age we live in. People come in with predetermined ideas on what they're expecting. And that's part of the art of medicine as opposed to the science of medicine. You have to identify that, and then you have to appropriately educate patients perhaps as to why their expectation may not be the appropriate course of action. And that takes time. And when it gets into litigation and things like this, you know, there are doctors that are jerks, and those doctors.
What? Wait a minute. No, really?
Yeah.
Seriously? There are doctors
yeah,
who are jerks?
Are.
I've never heard of such a thing.
Yeah, there's a few. Fortunately, most of them aren't, but there are a few, just like in any profession. And those folks tend to get sued more often, not necessarily because they don't have competence, but because the person had a negative interaction and they were mad. And so we know, in fact, Vanderbilt University has nationwide studies over 20 years that demonstrate that you're less likely to get sued as a physician, even if you don't know what you're doing, if you're nicer to patients.
That is fascinating. So the manner in which you deal with the patients can have a profound impact on the satisfaction level of that patient, regardless of skill or competency.
That's true. You'd like to think that everybody knows what they're doing and they're also nice. But every once in a while, and physicians are human, we get another news flash, and they make mistakes. I've made mistakes, and you hope that the mistakes you make don't harm people. But occasionally, you misdiagnose something or you go down the wrong path. And when that occurs, all the science, and there's a lot of data, like I said, from Vanderbilt, that says that if the physician apologizes, if the physician says, I made a mistake, if the physician has established a good doctor-patient relationship through developing trust and listening and talking, patients give you a break. And they're like, sorry, we get it. It's okay. And they're less tolerant of doctors who are arrogant and who don't have time to share with them. And they're more likely to sue those folks, whether they committed malpractice or not.
Fabulous. Hey, Dr. Bob, thanks for calling in this evening on KMOX.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
You too. I'm really glad he called in and shared his experience, because that gave you the real life firsthand account of what it's like dealing with patients and dealing with people who post reviews. Now, I'm going to give you just a couple of tips. If you want to post reviews, whether it's about a restaurant or a doctor or an attorney or anyone, just keep these things in mind, because there are three elements of libel. And I suspect that this particular doctor, again, I'm not using his name, I suspect, though, that he's done this before, that he uses attorneys a lot to intimidate people. I suspect that this is not the first time that he has done this type of behavior, whether it's with patients or with vendors. But here's a couple of things to keep in mind. If you're posting online, posting a review, stick to your opinions rather than statements of fact. Why? Because there are only three elements to libel. If someone's going to sue you for libel, they've got to prove three things. First, that you as the defendant made a false or defamatory statement concerning the plaintiff. Secondly, that the defendant, that being you, made the statement knowing that it was false, either knowing it was false or should have known that it was false. And third, that the publisher acted at least negligently in publishing that communication. That's if you're suing the publication. But in this instance, if you are a defendant, the plaintiff has to prove that what you posted was false, or that you knew that it was false and that you proceeded anyway to publish that particular defamatory statement. So if you stick to opinions, then those statements of fact cannot be proven. You know, the Covington situation where those boys who are wearing the MAGA hats in Washington, D.C., they are suing a lot of the Washington Post and a lot of the media over libel and slander. And ultimately, at the end of the day, I don't think those lawsuits are probably going to be successful, because most of what was said about those boys was opinion, not statements of fact. And so if you're going to post anything online, whether it's pizzas, about pizzas or physicians, stick to your opinions, stay away from statements of fact. And of course, if you do get in trouble, call an attorney. When we come right back, we are going to be talking to David Nicholas. He is the business columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And we're going to break down in St. Louis, we're going to break down the highs and the lows economically. We're going to talk about the successes during the past year, and maybe even during the past decade, of companies in St. Louis. And then we're going to look at where we're going to be going in the future economically in right here in the St. Louis region. Glad you're with us here on Overnight America. We'll be right back.
Hey.
Welcome back to Overnight America. Brad Young sitting in for Ryan Recker. And I mentioned that, you know, it's kind of, if you squint, it's the end of the decade. It's not technically, but it's good enough for discussion purposes. And one of the things that I wanted to check in on was with David Nicholas. He's the business columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and he's written a lot over the years. If you don't read his columns, you need to start, because his columns really tell you what's going on economically in the St. Louis area. And I'm very glad that you could join us this evening. David Nicholas, welcome to KMOX.
My pleasure, Brad.
Thanks for being here. Now, yesterday, you wrote an article that essentially has two main points. And the first is that the St. Louis economy had a pretty good year. So what are the highlights of the past year economically?
Oh, boy, there's been a lot. I mean, we had the GM strike, which had a big impact for a while. That was, you know, that was settled. We've had some big wins for the local economy, like Bunge moving its headquarters here, and some expansions by several of our local startups. You know, the entrepreneurial sector. We got Centene making a big acquisition and nearing completion on their headquarters expansion in Clayton. It's a pretty long list. And job wise, as of November, it looks like the area's added more than 20,000 jobs in the past year, which is pretty good historically speaking.
Yeah, how does that compare with previous years?
That would be the most since 2015. It's only actually three times this century that we've topped 20,000 jobs in a single year. So, I mean, if we close out at that level, December numbers aren't in yet, but if we close out at that level, it would be about 1.6% growth. That's actually a little faster than the nation is growing jobs, and not many years that you can say that about St. Louis.
Yeah, and one of the things you mentioned kind of as a low light, so to speak, was the GM strike. But once that GM strike concluded, I mean, it concluded with a lot of icing on top of the cake. I mean, there was the announcement of $1.5 billion in GM investment into the Wentzville plant. How's that going to impact our region in the coming years?
Well, of course, that kind of capital investment has spinoff effects. It employs construction workers, and they spend money in the local economy. You know, various contractors come in. So some of the money is going into parts plants and suppliers that will create jobs, feed parts into the GM plant, and it basically is a vote of confidence in the workforce in Wentzville and in the St. Louis area. GM's been closing plants around the country, so that will, you know, they've had a problem of excess capacity. But those trucks that they make in Wentzville are selling well, and apparently they like the quality of workforce they're finding here. So they're investing. That's good news.
That is good news. We're talking to David Nicholas, who's the business columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And one of the things I've noticed, David, over the last several years during this growth spurt we've been in nationally, is that the unemployment rate has gotten to historic lows. But commensurate with that, we've not seen much of a rise in wages. So lots of people were working, but no one or virtually no one was getting much of a raise. But in the past year, hasn't St. Louis seen a pretty significant rise in wages as well?
We have seen a pickup in the past year. I think what you said was true for most of the recovery. We saw kind of signs of workers sharing the wealth a little bit in the past year. In St. Louis, wages last 12 months are up 5 to 6%, which is about 3% ahead of inflation, and that's pretty close to the best we've seen in this recovery, and it's a good sign. I think it's correlates with that low unemployment rate, as businesses find it hard to recruit new workers. Mm-hmm. They tend to value the workers they have more and throw money their way and maybe sweeten the benefits package a little bit to make sure they keep them.
Right. And it's also not just for keeping employees, but if you've got job openings and no one's applying, one of the ways businesses fill those gaps, I know I run a business. I have a small business. This is what I have to do. If I can't fill the job at that price point, then I've got to pay more money to attract the kind of talent that I need. So we're seeing that happening in the St. Louis region is what I'm hearing from you.
Yeah, the signs of it starting to happen in 2019, and I would expect that to continue. I mean, the unemployment rate here is 3.1%. The lowest since records kept, which goes back to 1990 for the metropolitan areas. And just from my knowledge and research, I'm sure it's the lowest in at least 50 years, maybe more than that.
Now, economists like to use the term full employment, which I understand is around 5%. But can you explain in layman's terms, what does full employment mean?
Well, full employment basically means that that everyone who wants a job has one, and that there's only the unemployment rate never goes to zero because there's always some frictional unemployment. There's always some layoffs or people quit their job, and it takes them a while to find the new opportunity. Economists used to. The consensus used to be that it was around 5%, and then we saw in the dot-com boom in the late 90s, the unemployment rate got down below 4%, so they said, well, maybe full employment is around 4%. Now we're well below that, so it's better than we thought possible only a few years ago.
Well, one of the things that we hear, again, we're talking to David Nicholas, a business columnist for the Post-Dispatch. One of the things that we hear politically these days, and we've heard it actually for several years now, is the dwindling manufacturing jobs. And I'm talking nationwide. If you go to Rust Belt cities like Detroit or Cleveland or even in Chicago to some extent, you see a lot of these dwindling manufacturing jobs. But if you look at Boeing and GM and other areas, other companies around the St. Louis region, manufacturing, it's been a pretty good year for manufacturing, hasn't it?
It has. Manufacturers have added about around 2,000 jobs in the last 12 months, and that's building on they also had a pretty good year in 2018 they were hiring. I should have mentioned Boeing when we talked about the highlights. That's been a really quiet story. We wrote about it in the Post-Dispatch business section a few weeks ago. They've added nearly 2,000 jobs this year, and it's all because they've landed some more defense contracts. Their line is going strong.
And those aren't jobs. Those aren't minimum wage jobs over there at Boeing. No. Those are high paying jobs, aren't they?
Oh, very high paying. Yeah. Those are great jobs, as are the jobs at GM and many. I think that's also why you're starting to see the average wage figures go up. I think more of the jobs that are being created at this point in the recovery are, quote, good jobs, as opposed to some of the retail jobs and hospitality jobs entry level jobs that we were getting earlier on.
Thank you. We're talking to Post-Dispatch business columnist David Nicholas, and when we come back from this break, we're going to talk about the issue of corporate headquarters. Are those growing or diminishing in St. Louis? We're also going to talk about the David Nicholas's idea about that St. Louis needs a transformative decade, and we're going to get into that with him. Glad you're with us here on Overnight America. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Overnight America. Glad you're with us this evening. We're talking, you know who we're talking to, David Nicholas. He's the business columnist for the Post-Dispatch. He's the guy that has his finger on the economic pulse of St. Louis. Thanks for joining us this evening on KMOX, David.
Yeah, this is fun, Brad. I love talking about these issues.
Well, I do too, so I'm glad we can chat together. Whenever I graduated from law school, St. Louis U, in 1990, and when I graduated, St. Louis was in the top five cities in the United States for corporate headquarters. But now those days, are long gone. But with Bunge's establishment of their headquarters in Chesterfield, combined with Centene and the growth of Enterprise Leasing, just to name a few, is St. Louis still a major center for corporate headquarters?
It still is. I would say we're definitely above average in the number of headquarters that we have. You know, whether it's Fortune 500 or Fortune 1000, however you want to count it. We've actually, you know, we have lost a number of established headquarters, you know, mostly due to mergers. It's not like their companies are just leaving town. They're sure. Mostly being bought out, you know, like Anheuser-Busch was, Express Scripts, Monsanto.
Panera.
It's Panera. Yeah, it's a long list. But this is true of almost every other mid-sized city has lost headquarters in the same way. There are a few things going on here. I mean, one is there are fewer public companies today. Just consolidation, firms being bought by private equity and so on. The number of companies listed on the stock exchanges is way down. I did a calculation a couple of years ago, and yeah, the percentage decline in St. Louis just about matches the decline in number of listed companies overall. Also, there's been, you know, kind of increasing concentration, I would say, in the large coastal cities like New York, San Francisco, L.A.
Sure. I want to get back, though, to what you talked about in the article that you published yesterday in the Post-Dispatch. And the second point that you made in your article, just talking about where we've been in the last year, you kind of get out your crystal ball and you put on your Swami hat and you start looking forward. And you said this, you said that St. Louis needs a transformative decade. What do you mean by that?
Well, we've had good years and just the basic narrative about St. Louis hasn't really changed. We've got slow growing population, aging population. That's going to make it hard for companies to, you know, to see their way to hiring workers here. I'm already hearing from some employers that it's very hard to find workers in St. Louis, and you know, and that when they're deciding to expand, they may have to look elsewhere. So we need to look at ways to do a couple of things that, you know, in my book would be transformative. One, it would be to kind of address some of our underlying problems and make this a truly appealing city where people just want to move because it's vibrant and fun. The other would be to work on inclusion and making sure kind of the opportunities that exist here are available to everyone, regardless of what school district they live in, regardless of race, what county they live in, and so on.
Well, here's the thing that's amazing to me. I've got a brother-in-law who's an electrician, and and he's got literally as much work as he wants, anywhere he wants.
Yeah.
He's got plenty of work, and he's told me that these construction companies are literally just looking for people, and it's just fascinating to me that there are these jobs out there, particularly in the construction area. Again, high paying, although obviously it's skilled labor, but it's a high paying work. We just can't fill those positions. And I don't know that a lot of people grasp that there are open jobs that are right now going unfilled.
No, that's very true. The construction industry is booming here, and we barely started on the NGA campus, and we haven't started on the soccer stadium yet. So I think that boom's going to continue, in the year ahead and for the foreseeable future. And it's construction company executives tell me they're really concerned about filling all those jobs.
Well, you mentioned something that's on my list, David. And again, we're talking to David Nicholas, who's the business columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. You kind of briefly just mentioned the NGA, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. And when you talk about transformative, this is a billion-dollar project. It's going to be their regional headquarters for the NGA, built right here in St. Louis, really in the North St. Louis area. How transformative do you think that project will be for that particular area of St. Louis?
Well, I think that's an open question. I'm not sure if we're going to see, what kind of spinoff or adjacent development we're going to see. I mean, if it's just a few convenience stores and gas stations, then I think we will have failed in the mission to transform that area. But if it can lead to some development of new housing and other office developments for, say, the many private firms that do business with the NGA and other service providers, then I think it could be the start of a transformation.
One of the other things that you mentioned in your article is crop technology. Now, I got to tell you, that does not sound sexy. when you're talking about, wow, they're doing crop technology. Wow, welcome to the 1800s, I mean, that's what it sounds like. But St. Louis is becoming a major focus for crop technology. But what is that? What does that mean?
Well, that's kind of advances in genetics and advances in bringing computing power, combining computing power with genetic engineering and genetic techniques to improve crop varieties. I mean, there's a company called Benson Hill. They're actually building a new headquarters out in Crèvecoeur. They just topped that building out. And they've been hiring dozens of people this year. They'll move into the new building next year. It's really a big success story. And there are, I think we've got several other firms like them, kind of coming down the pike.
Well, that was the major driving force, wasn't it, behind Bayer's decision to buy Monsanto, was the whole crop technology agricultural focus that they have right here in St. Louis.
Oh, sure. They've got those Monsanto labs out in Chesterfield, they're doing work that Bayer probably couldn't do in Europe just because of the regulations and kind of the unwelcoming climate toward GMO crops. So they've got a tremendously valuable workforce here. I think they've said they're going to keep investing in that and probably move jobs here over time, especially in the research areas. But we've got the Danforth Plant Science Center. That's a world class asset, and that combination of a big commercial company in Bayer and the basic research, that's why a lot of these kind of leaders in crop technology and the entrepreneurs in the sector are choosing to expand in St. Louis.
Well, I think it's interesting that when Bayer bought Roundup, Monsanto, that there were some people who expressed dismay at, oh my goodness, they just spent billions of dollars buying this company, and now they're getting hit with these lawsuits. Couldn't someone have seen this happening? But my point has always been this, and I want to see if you agree with me. I don't believe for a moment that Bayer wasn't aware of this potential litigation. But I think in the calculation from Bayer's perspective, the benefits of having the agricultural-based businesses right here in St. Louis for research and development, that was so lucrative for them that they were willing to take on the potential liability of Roundup in order to get the other agribusiness.
Oh, yeah. No, they saw the agribusiness sector at a crossroads. I mean, Syngenta, one of the big companies in the sector, had just been bought by the Chinese. Dow and DuPont were in the process of combining. I think Bayer, so they had to make a big move or they would be left behind. And Monsanto had probably the best technology in the industry. So they wanted that badly. They paid a premium price. Yeah, maybe they did. Yeah, they knew about the Roundup lawsuits. Maybe they underestimated the
exposure.
The exposure, and yeah, the way that American juries are going to put out some eye-popping awards in those cases. They'll deal with it, and
sure.
the business will go on. I think, you know, it's going to cost them some money to settle those cases if or to continue to fight it in court.
And of course, my point is, I always just hope they make sure and pay the lawyers, because that's very very important that we pay the lawyers. Hey, last question.
I think there are several lawyers who are going to do well on that.
Listen, lawyers got to eat too. I got kids going to college. You know, we got our own expenses
sure.
here.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
But last question for David Nicholas, business columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Just from your own personal opinion, we've talked about lots of economic things here tonight. I know a lot of mm-hmm. folks aren't that excited about economics. I am, because it's what drives everything else. But from your perspective, we talked about Bayer and Express Scripts and Centene and
yeah.
GM and the NGA and Bunge and all these things. But what would you say, from your perspective, is the top St. Louis business story of the last decade?
Oh, the top story of the last decade. I would say it's probably Bayer buying Monsanto, and we're still only about a year and a half into that transition. But I think it's going to go okay for St. Louis. But that was certainly a big business deal and a big investment.
Very good.
That would be my number one. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, I appreciate you spending some time with us this evening. David Nicholas, business columnist for the Post-Dispatch. Thanks for being on Overnight America.
Oh, it's been fun, Brad.
Good.
Thanks.
We'll hopefully get a chance to talk to you again soon. When we come back from this break, we've got lots of other things on tap for this evening, including, whom do you think Americans chose as the most admired man in 2019? We're going to dive into that fray, as well as phone lines are open. I want to get your perspective on what predictions do you have for the next decade or the next year? 314-436-7900 or 1-800-925-1120. Brad Young sitting in for Ryan Recker on Overnight America. Boy, I'm glad David Nicholas could stick around. I kept him a little longer than what I had told him when we spoke earlier today, but he really does have his finger on the pulse of St. Louis region economically. Make sure you check out his articles on a regular basis at thepostdispatch.com. I mentioned predictions. And in the next hour, I'm going to go through, not predictions, I'm going to look backwards a little bit to talk about how in the last decade we've seen some transformative, and that's a term that David Nicholas used several times in his recent columns about economic issues. But there have been lots of things that have been transformative that we've seen in the last 10 years that have been amazingly transformative. Let me tell you the context. When I was a kid, I was fascinated when I would talk to my grandparents. And they lived, my grandparents were born, depending on which set of grandparents you're talking about, they were born in the very early 1900s, 02, 03, 04, and they all died basically in the 80s and 90s. But from the period of their lifetimes, think about it, from the beginning of the 1900s through the 1980s or 1990s, they went from seeing the first airplane, maybe they didn't see it, maybe they were really young or an infant or something, but in their lifetimes, we went from the first flight of an airplane to landing on the moon in one generation. And I was always in awe of that progress in a single lifetime. And yet, if we look backwards, and we really don't have the context for this yet, but I want to talk a little bit about this in the next hour, about what we've seen from a transformational perspective, just for the last 10 years. And maybe we don't realize it yet because we're in the midst of it, but later on, our kids or grandkids are going to look back and say, wow, you were living in the 2010s when blank happened. They're going to look at this, I think, years from now, as I looked at my grandparents and was in awe of what happened in their lifetime from the first flight to the landing on the moon. They're going to look back and maybe compare those events. And so we're going to get into that in the next hour. But if you want to talk about predictions, I jotted down just a few this afternoon, predictions that I have for the coming decade. And I'd certainly like to know if you agree with these or maybe you've got some of your own. But here's a couple that in no particular order. I just jotted down about 10 predictions that we'll see in the next 10 years. It'll be the battery decade. You know, in 2010, think about this, 10 years ago, batteries powered our phones and our computers, but not much more. Now they're starting to power our cars and our homes. And so the reliance on our phones is only going to increase. It's the best way to capture solar and wind power, and personal data storage is just going to increase. And so for all of those reasons, I think we're going to see batteries explode. And I don't mean like on a plane or if you're vaping. I'm talking about the use of batteries, the efficiency of batteries, the proliferation of batteries. The other thing that we're going to see, and we're coming up on the clock in about a minute left, but the other thing I think we're going to see in the next 10 years, and this is, I'm no Nostradamus, but I think you're going to see the death of cable television. And what's going to kill cable television is very simple. Economics combined with technology. So as it becomes easier and cheaper to get programs, you're not going to need to pay those confiscatorily high cable TV bills. You're not going to need to pay them if you can get the same content on the air, over the air, through the internet, or on your phone, or through your phone, or whatever method of technology you want to use. You won't need cable television. The last point I'm going to make, and I'll get into some more of these predictions in the next hour, but we're going to see the politicization, the polarization, rather, of our political parties. More and more polarization. Republicans, I think, are going to become more libertarian, and Democrats are going to become more socialistic. You're going to see these parties move further and further to the extremes, primarily, I think, because of 24-hour news. But you're going to see that polarization increase over the next 10 years. We're already seeing it. You know, at the last Democrat debate, they were turning left faster than cars at the Indy 500. So, you know, you saw that. And when we come back in the next hour, we'll get into this in more detail on Camo X, Brad Young, sitting in on Overnight America.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.